You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina, in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Listening to the cycling podcast Femina, brought to you by Skoda, dedicated to closing the gender gap in cycling, one race, one cyclist at a time. This is our time.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Orla Shinawee.
Hello, hello.
Not Rose Manley, sadly, this month. We are in Madrid. Rose isn't here. We've just watched the Madrid Challenge and we'll have a little report from that, some interviews from that race, which was won overall by Lisa Brenner. Chloe Hosking won the second stage here, basically a big criterium. This episode, the centrepiece of this episode, a large part of the middle is taken up with Orla and I discussing her recent article in Ruler magazine, all about the sort of Me Too movement as it applies to cycling. Although it's pretty dark in places, the article, and we talk about the process of researching it and writing it and some of the reaction to it as well. So we'll hear a lot about that later on in the episode. But here in Madrid, as I say, Lisa Brenner was the overall winner of the Madrid Challenge. Chloe Hosking won the big bunch sprint for the second stage. Lisa Brenner won the time trial, which was the first stage. Letizia Paternoster was second, Roxanne Fournier third, and Lucinda Brand fourth. And she lost her passport on the way over, Orla.
I didn't know that. What happened?
She lost her passport.
There's not more to the story than the headline is also the body of the story.
That's it. Okay. She's like Daniel Freeb. He lost his passport as well.
She'll have to get it back before the World. She's all right travelling within Europe, but she'll need it back for the World Championships, won't she?
Britain's still within Europe, but I know what you mean. We're not part.
We're not part of Schengen.
I know. So yeah, that's what she's worried about.
You're not part of Schengen. I know.
Yorkshire's coming up, and that is a concern. But I'm sure she'll get it sorted out. Brand finished second overall in the Madrid Challenge. Pernille Mathisson was third. That's her Sunweb teammate, and Christine Majerus of Bols Dolmans was fourth, and I spoke to her. She won the Bols Ladies Tour recently. I spoke to her at the finish. We'll hear from her later on. In terms of a news roundup, I'm doing it this time because Orla's otherwise engaged at the moment.
Don't give me that. Hang on a minute. That's not fair. Rich has been very naughty because I'm mid on air at the moment and I've ducked away from my... I haven't ducked away from anything. I'm free for the moment. But I did notice earlier while we were doing our preview show on Eurosport that my nails are a bit filthy, as in my nail polish is rather chipped. And so I thought I'd better sort that out before our final show of the year. So yes, I'm painting my nails as we're chatting. But that's not why you're doing the news roundup. You're doing the news roundup because I've been on the road for the last 3 weeks, basically, and that's that. Yeah, I've been at the full Vuelta.
That's true, Orla, and I'm sorry to don't know what I did to you there. But anyway, we have to go all the way back to the Women's Tour of Scotland because we recorded our last episode just before the first ever Women's Tour of Scotland. And unfortunately, the first stage was stopped because of extreme weather, so we didn't have a winner there. But the other two stages were run off okay, and it seems to have been a great success. The race was won overall by Leah Thomas of Bigla Pro Cycling, ahead of Alison Jackson of Team Tibco. So it was a decent field, and it seemed like a really good race. Terrible weather, but there's nothing they can really do about that. In other racing, Ellen van Dijk won the European time trial title. Amy Peters won the road race in Vårgårda. In the team time trial, Trek Segafredo beat Canyon SRAM, the world champions, of course, but no team time trial for trade teams this year. So, you know, it makes these team time trials perhaps have a little bit less meaning. Vårgårda was a great build-up to the, and almost a preview, a dress rehearsal for the world championships. That's no longer the case. The road race at Vårgårda was won by Marta Bastianelli, back on form after a brilliant early start of the season and a bit of time out with injury. But she won there ahead of Marianne Vos and Lorena Vibes. Lorena Vibes. At the Ladies Tour of Norway, it was Vibes again who won a stage, but then it was Vos. She won three stages to win the overall. Colorado Classic, she was outdone, Vos, by Chloe Dyger-Owen. Not that Vos was riding the Colorado Classic, but Chloe Dyger-Owen won all four stages of that race, and she won them all alone. There wasn't any bunch sprints there, so she won overall by 2.5 minutes. At the Grand Prix Plouay, Anna van der Breggen was the winner ahead of Corn Rivera and Amy Peters. the Bulls Ladies Tour, I mentioned that earlier on. Chrissy Majerus was the winner with Viva second and Lisa Klein third. Majerus didn't actually win a stage. The stage won by, well, Vibus won two. There were splits on stage three, and Lisa Klein won from a small group that included Amy Peters and Lizzie Deignan. Franziska Koch of Sunweb won stage four, and Chiara Consoni from Valcar won stage five, outsprinting Lorena Vibus, a rare defeat for her. At the Lotto Belgium Tour, Prologue was won by Ruth Winder of Trek Segafredo. Then Mika Kroger won a stage, Karin Rivera won two, and Kroger won overall. The Cycliste Féminin Internationale de l'Ardèche. It's a seven-day race, finishes later this week, and at the time of recording this episode, with the first three stages run, they have all been won by Marina Voss, clearly in great form ahead of the World Championships. And that brings us right up to the Madrid Challenge, Orla. In other news, Chloe Hosking and Jessica Allen have been called up to the Australian team for the Road Race World Championship after Grace Brown and Sarah Roy have had to pull out with injuries after crashes. Leah Kirchman crashed in the Bulls Ladies Tour, and she's out for the rest of the season. And Ellen Van Dijk also crashed there, and she broke her arm and her pelvis. Nasty. And that takes out one of the favourites for the time trial at the World Championships. There's a lot of crashes in that first stage of the Bulls Ladies Tour, and Annemiek van Vleuten came down, didn't hurt herself too badly, but she wasn't very happy about that. The Dutch team for the World Championships, no Lorena Vibus. Now, it's a very hilly course, so that's maybe understandable, but the team is Anna van der Bergen, Chantal Black, Lucinda Brand, Amy Peters, Flirty Mackay, Annemiek van Vleuten, Demi Vollering, and Marianne Vos. That's not a bad team, is it?
In my life, it's not bad at all. I mean, even getting on that team is an achievement in itself, I would say, because, I mean, almost any one of them could win. Demi Vollering is somebody who's caught my eye this season. I think she's phenomenal. I would say the Dutch are going to be very, very hard to beat. Really?
Breaking news.
Breaking news.
I mean, Demi Vollering is actually my outside tip for that race, but Marianne Vos looks in exceptional form, and she's not been racing all that much recently. She's been preparing a lot as well. I was speaking to Dan Hackenberg, our colleague from the Dutch media, and he's very confident that it could be Vos again. Who knows?
Lizzie Deignan is one you've got to be looking out for, obviously, for the world, but not Dutch. There you go. And more breaking news.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to Rafa for their support of the Cycling Podcast Femina. And Rafa will have a couple of pop-ups in Harrogate for the World Championship week. If you want to watch the racing there or check out what events they've got on, go to rafa.cc. Orla, we're in Madrid, as I mentioned. The Madrid Challenge has been and won. And Chloe Hosking was the winner here. It's been a difficult season for her. And I spoke to her at the finish to find out exactly what these difficulties were and what today's win means to her. Well, you must be delighted with that.
I am. I'm really happy. I'm relieved. I'm proud of myself for getting through all the tough bits of the season. And then, yeah, big race to get a win. And my mum's here. So, and also the girls rode phenomenal today. So it's always more special when it feels like a real team effort.
Well, you were saying how much help you got from your team. I mean, they really took it on in the last few kilometres.
Yeah, when it started raining, then girls just started crashing. And we were sort of like, you know, playing it safe. And then there was another crash up on this corner. I think it was like a lap and a half to go, which is still too early to take over the front. But I just said, come on, girls, let's go to the front. And so Romy Casper and Carl Einswinkles got us there, and they just buried themselves to keep us at the front. And then, yeah, Romy was still on the front coming up the with a K to go. So, you know, we played it safe, and it worked out for us.
You mentioned that it had been a difficult season, or there have been some tough moments this year. What's been the toughest?
Yeah, I just had a really bad spring, and you know, you get all up in your head. You think, oh, like, am I good enough anymore? Like, can I still do this? And so I took a step back in May. But you know, you're still thinking, oh, all these girls have got all these phenomenal results and I have nothing. So to pick yourself up and then still have the confidence in yourself to back yourself for a race like this, like, it takes a lot. And I'm really lucky that I have a great support network around me, and I'm quite a resilient girl. So, no, I'm really proud of myself, and I'm really happy that I, you know, took the time to figure out, like, what I needed to do to get back to where I wanted to be. And I do feel like, particularly in August and now into September, I'm back to where I want to be and where people expect me to be.
And you've had a late call up to the World Championships as well.
Yeah, it's quite unfortunate. You know, we had two girls in Sarah Roy and Grace Brown out with injury, and they're, you know, two powerhouse riders. So, you know, it's disappointing for the Aussie squad, but for me personally, I didn't have the results in the early season to get selected for Worlds, but I do feel like now, you know, I'm coming into some great form, and I'll be able to play a really good role for the Aussies at Worlds. And I'm not there to be a waste of space. I'm there to help the team and try and get a great result.
Well, it was a great team performance from Ali Cipollini to set up Chloe Hosking. So we thought we'd hear from a couple of her teammates too. First up, Diana Peniela of Colombia.
It was great because we won, so that's really satisfactory. So, yeah, the course was a little crazy with the rain the last five laps, but yeah, I enjoy so much because we have a good team for this kind of race, so I love it. It's like a big event. Yesterday, yeah, we don't have a lot of spectators, but yeah, I think race in the same time with the men's make that so much people can watch the women's race, so I think it's really good. So much people here, not only for the men's. I hope so they also know that it's two Colombian girls racing today, so yeah, it's amazing.
I am Marjolein van het Geloof from Ale Cipollini. It was hectic. In the first, I think, 15 laps or so it was okay, but then the rain came and it just went crazy, and the first crashes everyone was just scared and trying to stay alive, and we did a really good job of keeping Chloe in front, and yeah, the girls were so strong and going with every attack, and we could finish it off. It's very good that they try to get the women riding with the men's races. I think it gives us a good audience, and also like for us to do a stage race and maybe make it bigger in other years. It's a big step forward for women's cycling.
The overall winner, as I said, Lisa Brenner. And again, I was surprised to learn this was her first ever World Tour win for somebody who's, well, because the big races that she won, I think she won before the Women's World Tour was started. So she said it was her first World Tour win. So there you go.
She would know, wouldn't she? That's really, really amazing, actually. I hadn't realised that.
Well, she's had a couple of kind of underwhelming seasons where her progress seemed to stall. And let's hear what she said at the finish, Orla, because she's very happy to have won here, obviously. But looking ahead to the World Championships in Yorkshire with great excitement. Here's Lisa Brenner at the finish today in Madrid. Congratulations. I mean, you built the win on yesterday's result, I guess, but defended it very well and aggressively today.
Yeah, it was a super hectic and challenging race. You always had to be there with your head and also ready to sprint for the intermediate seconds. And so I think it was a really exciting race, and because with all the seconds that were still on the road, yeah, this race got a special character and a really big fight.
You must also, though, have, when it got quite dangerous, you must have been thinking about Yorkshire as well, and worried about not taking any risks, because Yorkshire is obviously a huge goal for you.
Yeah, Yorkshire or not, I'm really a rider. I don't like to take much risk as I have to take, so try to take it a bit easy, and especially in the corners and the slippery sections, because that's my style of racing, and I'm usually never too risky, and that's also my path I follow today.
And in Yorkshire, is the time trial your big focus there?
I'm now selected for all the three events in Yorkshire, and it's a good question. I mean, to be honest, I haven't been top 10 the last years in a time trial, so I really want to show this year that I'm back in good shape and that I can do a good result in a time trial. So that's a big goal. But I also think we have a really strong but very young squad for the road race, and I think the circuit suits us, so we definitely want to play a role there as well, and not knowing if I will be the lead rider or anybody else in the team, because I think we have a pretty good team where we can play different cards, and I just want to do a very good job there.
And what are your expectations from the team time trial? What do you, I mean, do you know what to expect there?
Yeah, I've done it now at European Championships, and I like this event with Lisa Klein and Mieke Kröger from the women's side of the German team. We are really strong, but I heard that also the men's will send a strong squad. And so I think it's a race that suits us as a German team, and we showed at Europeans that we are up there, and you have to counter with us for a medal, and I think it will be really a goal for us to go for a medal there.
That is a strong all in form, all won recently, you, Lisa Klein, and Mika Kruger as well.
Yeah, I think we are a good TTT team to be. I mean, if you saw the latest result, also Mika, she's in great shape. She just won the Lotto Belgium Tour and had a strong time trial as well in Chrono Champenois. So, and Lisa Klein in third place in Holland Ladies Tour. So, yeah, I think we can put our expectations high.
Lisa Brenner there, looking ahead to the World Championships in Yorkshire, as we all are. And she talked quite enthusiastically about the team time trial as well, the mixed relay. They rode that at the European Championships recently. And so they've had a kind of trial run. She seemed to quite enjoy it. They've got a very strong team on the women's side. She's not sure yet which men will be riding, but she seems up for all three events.
She showed that, you know, she is, I guess, at the top of her game once again. She's 31. As you say, remarkably hasn't won a women's world tour race. She's been national champion and whatnot. So somebody on Twitter once picked up on me saying whatnot, which I never realised until Twitter. So now I'm really conscious of saying it, and I've just said it. Anyway, taking the individual time trial win yesterday was really impressive. It's a much shorter course, though, isn't it? It was like 9 kilometres or something compared to the longer Yorkshire course. But that would give her momentum, at least anyway. And certainly that being her first Women's World Tour win will give her a huge boost psychologically, you would think, going into the Worlds.
Strange race, this, isn't it? I mean, it was a team time trial and then a circuit race last year, a time trial, individual time trial and circuit race this year. 2.5 hours around this circuit. It's a long way for a circuit race. It got pretty treacherous with the rain, and there were quite a few crashes. I don't know. It's not really established itself, this race. You know, a lot of teams missing here. Canyon SRAM aren't here. CCC aren't here. A lot of the big names aren't here. So I'm not sure about it. I spoke to Claude Sun at the finish. He's the big boss at WNT, who sponsored this race and also the women's team that Lisa Brenner rides for. So I spoke to him a bit about this season, because they've really stepped up with Brenner and Kirsten Veld joining. I wondered, because we had an interview on the cycling podcast last week with Javier Guillen, the Vuelta director, who talked about his plans to start a one-week women's race that wouldn't be at the same time as the Vuelta. So I asked Claude Sun a bit about that as well. Here's what he said at the finish. You've really stepped up this season. You sponsor this race, and your rider, Lisa Brenner, who you know very well, she's from the same town as the sponsor, she's won today, so you must be very happy.
Yeah, she's happy, particularly this is World in Yorkshire next week, so it's a good, she's confident for next week. This was important. I think yesterday the time trial was important for her also. On today it was very, very dangerous. It was wet. And she was at the end a little bit. She told me she was, very dangerous. So at the last sprint was not so, but it's a very, very nice day for the team, for the sponsor, for us.
And I mean, I say you sponsor this race. We spoke to Javier Guillen, the Vuelta director, last week. He said he'd like to organise a week-long stage race for women. Are you aware of those plans? Would you like to be involved in that?
Yeah, we are involved from the beginning by the Vuelta, yeah, because we contact them, I think, 3 years ago. Vuelta, the decision was, should we continue, should we not? And we said, okay, we invest, because Spain is very important for us. Blond Awareness also for us in Spain, and we decided to make last year we did in 2 days, was a TTT. And honestly, we are in contact a little bit. Yeah, we are most in contact with Unipublic. And then we discuss always a little bit together. They ask us what we think, to improve a little bit. And then it would be nice to have perhaps 3 days, you know.
And you've, stepped up this year with the likes of Lisa and Kirsten Veld and others. Next year, will you be a World Tour team? Have you applied to be a World Tour team?
No, It was the first idea was yes, because I'm completely convinced that it's a good idea from Lapartien on UCI to go in this direction for the lady. Later on, we said, we have to think a little bit more because we've got a lot of young riders. We would like to have a mix between experienced riders like Lisa Kirsten. We've got very young riders like Laura Asensio, Lynn Tottenberg. On the new world tour, I would say regulation, for me, it's not very, not complete fix with young riders, you know. And then we've got some riders for the track. And I think it's a good idea, but we prefer to wait a little bit, honestly.
I think this race is a funny one, isn't it? Because it almost feels like with the Tour and with the Vuelta, it feels like an obligation, really, doesn't it? And I think, to be fair to La Course, it has taken on a certain element of a life of its own. It's proven itself to be a race that is thrilling to watch most years now that they've taken it away from that crit in Paris. The problem here is that it is still a city crit, essentially. Yeah, you've got the time trial the day before, but there's no television coverage of that. And when I was speaking to a few people yesterday at the top of the mountain, people who are really interested in women's cycling, they said, oh, it's such a shame La Madrid Challenge is just one day again this year. They didn't realise that there was an individual time trial. And today, there's only so much you can really showcase. And that arguably is the reason you've got this kind of a race. It's to give a platform and a showcase to women's cycling, isn't it? Because you've got Ardèche happening at the same time when you've got a huge field there. So you've got a reduced field here. And the argument would be to show how exciting, how dynamic it is. We had on Eurosport earlier, Joanna Reusel was saying about how women's racing is so different. It's something we've talked about a lot, but how much more attacking it can be. You just don't see that on a course like this. And that is a shame. You know, you've got to sprint every other lap, and that's all you've got to sustain you for the 16 laps, barring, unfortunately, the crashes. So it doesn't get me interested at all. It's one of those, I guess, like the Prudential Ride London. I haven't given that the full title, have I? Classic something. The London Prudential one, where you can tune in for the last, I don't know, 15 minutes and not really have missed too much. I mean, it was a great ride by Lisa Brennauer today because everyone was talking about Kirsten Wild and almost as if the sprint win was sewn up. And Brennauer did a really good job of soaking up those intermediate sprints. She came into today with a 4-second buffer on the lead. She finished today with a 10-second buffer. So by the time that rain came, she already had done enough, really, to not have to risk too much. So it was brilliant racing from her. But you have to look hard to find that kind of racing here. You know, it's not like a hilly course. It's not like a La Course in the mountains. So it just doesn't... I find it very, very underwhelming, unfortunately. Sorry.
Well, another recent winner who was riding today and finished fourth in the end was Christine Majerus, but she won the Bulls Ladies Tour recently, a very important race for her team, Bulls Dolmans, of course. She's a Luxembourg champion, and I spoke to her at the finish as well. Pretty treacherous towards the end.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of hoped it would stay dry. It was good racing till it started raining, and we know that the roads in Spain are getting really slippery when it's raining, and... Yeah, there were actually quite a few crashes, and the goal was just to stay safe. And we came here for Jolene, trying. It was her first race back after a heavy injury, but I think she was also not so comfortable with the risk with the rain. So yeah, we did our best. I think we did good GCs, good TTs yesterday, and we couldn't be happy.
Is this a race you enjoy?
Very seriously, no, I don't really enjoy this. I mean, I know it's nice to be part of the Vuelta. But I think we would also deserve more than just a crit. It's nice that it's two days already. Like now, that was the TT, but it would be nice to make it at least 3 days with a longer race, where breakaways might have a little bit more chance than here. It's literally impossible to get away. So, yeah, I mean, it's nice to be here, but it's, for me at least, not the most enjoyable race.
I wanted to ask you about your win as well at the Bulls Ladies Tour recently. You must have been delighted with that.
Yeah, of course. It's my biggest victory of my career in the World Tour, the home race of the team. Couldn't be more proud of that. The team did a really amazing job, and it was cool to have the jersey in the team. Well, life continues, but I'm also happy that I keep going with another good result in the World Tour here. I think with the bonus, I move up one place, so that's fifth. Pretty good end of the season.
And you're going to World Championships in Yorkshire, looking forward to those?
Yeah, I like racing in the UK. I love the Uber Women's Tour. I hope that my shape stays, I improve a little bit more. Till then, it's still 2 weeks. I mean, the work is done. It's all about just staying safe, recover well, and then fingers crossed the shape is good that day.
What's it like for you going from riding throughout the season for, you know, one of the strongest teams to riding for Luxembourg, where it's probably it's probably a little bit different in terms of support and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always proud to wear the national team jersey to represent my country, but on the other side, it's really hard for me to really have an input in the race because I'm alone. I actually can only follow and hope that I can profit a little bit out of situations. I mean, I'm also not the strongest rider in the world, so it's also not that I can do something all alone. So it's a little bit more of a lottery for me, actually, every time I'm in the national kit. And yeah, I hope it works out. And if not, then season was still good.
Well, Chrissy Majerus of Bulls Dolmenseren. One thing missing from my news roundup was the news of which teams have applied for World Tour status next year. There are going to be 5 licenses at a minimum available. And a team that wasn't there, we heard from Claude Sun earlier saying that they hadn't applied for a World Tour license, but Bulls Dolmens haven't had it. And I gather, Orla, from you, that there's a little bit of uncertainty around the team.
There is, and they're going to announce it, I think, at the World Championships. They don't want to steal their thunder, preempt anything. But for the team that has given us so much in this sport, I mean, really, you've got to take your hats off to how professional they have made this sport. And at some stages, it felt like, not single-handedly, because there are lots of hands on that team, but, I don't know, multiple-handedly, but single-teamedly, that's now a word. Single-teamedly and whatnot. They've raised the bar in this sport and in women's cycling, and the sport owes them, I think, genuinely an awful lot, and an awful lot to the sponsors who have put the money into that. We have seen now other teams and men's World Tour teams crossing over and bringing women's teams, and I guess they can afford to put more money into their women's teams. You know, Trek have got a big budget, Mitchelton Scott have done incredibly well. So I don't know how much the landscape has changed financially, but there is some uncertainty over them for next year, and we wait to hear what their announcement is going to be at the World Championships. I'm also hoping to catch up with Danny Stam whenever he gets back from the Worlds, and I've got some work away when we get back together again in October. He lives not far from Amsterdam, so I'm hoping to catch up with him and reflect on what's been an incredible life of the team so far, and hopefully more going forward, and to get under the skin a little bit of what the situation is for next year.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, this episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina is supported by Heist. Heist is on a mission to take away the frustration every woman has with their underwear. They've already revolutionised tights and shapewear. Stop laughing, Orla. And there's more coming in 2020. Orla, I mean, you're a big fan.
I am a big fan, and sorry, I'm only laughing because you look a little bit uncomfortable and you're trying really
totally
hard
comfortable.
Not to. Really hard not to. I am a huge fan, and I've already waxed lyrical about the tights, which I'm a big, big fan of. I have this bodysuit that Heist make, and I took it out to the Vuelta, and I wasn't sure whether I was going to wear it as underwear or outerwear, and it was a hot day in the mountains, and I thought, well, I'll put it on and I'll see. Stripped off, and the other girls on my crew were in love with it. They just the look of it, and they were in love with the look of it. They didn't feel it, obviously, but it's wonderful. So it's a bodysuit that you can wear as underwear or as outerwear. It feels so smooth and so supportive, and you don't need to wear any other underwear underneath it. It's also, as a bodysuit, it's got little clips at the bottom, so it's not like a swimsuit, obviously. I don't know why I'm explaining that, because the women listening will know. But it comes in a multitude of colours. I went for black to be safe the first time, but it comes in really lovely sort of neon, fresh, bright colours. So I'm going to go for a few of those now that I'm feeling a bit brave with it. It's beautiful. I love it.
Sounds great. Heist has an in-house team of material scientists and garment innovators known as Lab 12, creating its products. This team, Lab 12, applies the same level of physiological research and technological innovation to underwear that has previously only been used in the sportswear category. And you mentioned this last month, Orla, that it's led by Fiona Fairhurst, who was the inventor of the revolutionary multi-gold medal winning fast skin swimsuit.
And that's the thing about the bodysuit. It feels like it's made to be worn in the way it's worn. and that sounds a bit silly, but a lot of clothes just aren't. The fabric of it is absolutely beautiful, and I don't want to sound weird, but you just keep like rubbing at it because it feels so comfortable. So I've done yoga in it as well, and it just sort of stretches with your body, but it basically feels like the most comfortable swimsuit you will ever wear, and it supports you in all the right places. It's just, yeah, it's beautiful. The fabric of it is a joy.
You like it then?
Just a bit.
Okay, shop now at heiststudios.com. That's heist-studios.com, and that's H-E-I-S-T. And for 15% off, use the code HEIST15 at the checkout. That's H-E-I-S-T-15. That's 15. And it's capital letters, H-E-I-S-T in capital letters. Heiststudios.com with the code HEIST15 at the checkout. This month's episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina is also supported by The Economist. The Economist is a smart guide to the forces impacting your world. It's about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, arts, environment, and also sport. It helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them. It sifts through the noise, focusing on the essential information that tells the real story at a time when facts matter more than ever. It's been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years, and it's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. That sounds like a description of you, Orla.
But I like that. Yeah,
add that to your Twitter profile.
I will. It's a bit long. I'm not sure I'll fit it into all the characters.
Not everything. An article that caught my eye was about part-time work. Part-time jobs help women stay in paid work, but they can also hold women back. And it begins with an anecdote about your country of residence. Getting hold of a Dutch woman on a Wednesday can be tricky. For most primary schools, it is a half day, and as three quarters of working women are part-time, it's a popular day to take off. The Dutch are world champions at part-time work and are often lauded for their healthy work-life balance and happy children. But these come at a price. Among Western European countries, the Netherlands has the largest gap between men's and women's pension entitlements and the largest in monthly income.
That's really surprising. What they do brilliantly in the Netherlands is sharing part-time work and sharing childcare. So whether you're a man or a woman, you are allowed to work 4 days a week until your child is eight. So it's not a request that can be refused. I think it's until they're eight, and it's statutory that it should not impede your career progression. So it shouldn't get in the way of your career as you're working part-time, and then when you go back to full-time. So it surprises me that there is that larger discrepancy, but yeah, I mean, it's true that on a Wednesday, usually you will see the mums picking up the kids from school, because we finish at 12:30 usually instead of 3 o'clock. And I think that they do achieve that balance really well between the men and the women generally.
There is another strange, no, not so strange, discrepancy. There's a discrimination. Men's requests to work part-time are more likely than women's to be rejected.
I'm not surprised by that at all. And I think that's absolutely awful. But I think we're only moving into a generation now where paternity leave, shared with maternity leave, is starting to become more of a thing. But when I say more of a thing, we're still talking tiny fractions of the population. But that's where the Netherlands is really good, because you're not allowed to refuse it if you want to work 4 days a week as a man. And so if you need extra help doing childcare, there's generally only 3 days a week where you need someone from the outside to be looking after your kids. So that means that 4 days a week they're with their parents, which is really good.
Well, it's a very, very interesting article about all the advantages and disadvantages of working part-time. And as two people who work part-time, I can relate to a lot of it.
If by part-time you mean about 5 full-time jobs, including parenting, then yeah, I guess we fall into that category.
Yes. Okay, well, there's that and a lot more of interest in The Economist. I read it regularly. I've also been listening at the Vuelta to their podcast, The Intelligence, which is a daily kind of little dose of news from all over the world. It's really good, well worth listening to. It's a smart guide to the forces changing your world, and if you've never stopped asking questions, you can get your free copy now. Just text the word BIKES to 78070 to get a free print copy of The Economist. Text the word BIKES, B-I-K-E-S. Why am I spelling BIKES?
Could be BIX like the pen,
yeah,
but it's
BIKES to 78070. I'm with Orla Shinawee. We're in Burgos on the second rest day of the Vuelta. And Orla, it's a few weeks now since a piece of work of yours was published in Ruler, a big article, a really substantial bit of work on sexism in cycling. And it was pretty explosive. A shorter version of the article was published online, and in the magazine itself was a much longer version with a lot of detail, a lot of people, some of them anonymous, telling you their stories about some experiences they'd had. And I know that you were working on this for quite a long time. I think we spoke about it at the women's tour back in June. Can you just tell me the origins of the story, how it sort of the genesis of it?
Yeah, as you say, it took quite a few months to do. I think it was March maybe, whenever Ruler approached me about it. It was Andy McGrath, their editor, who got in touch and said, listen, we're just thinking of doing an article. And he very hesitantly bracketed it, me too, but he just wanted to explore what the situation was in women's cycling. His thinking was that we hadn't had a Me Too moment, if you like, in cycling, and we've had it in other spheres. And he wanted to find out why not. Is it because there is no Me Too moment to be had, or is it because we just don't know what's going on yet? And I just find the concept really interesting, and to be honest, probably came at it with not my mind made up, but I certainly had a view on it, which was then blown to pieces. Because as a journalistic exercise, I thought this will be interesting to explore, and I'd like to find out what there is to find out, if anything. But my thinking was, you know, we've been working in cycling for a number of years now, which is why he asked me to do it. And I just assumed if there was an issue, we'd know about it. And which seems remarkably naive now, whenever you think about how stories come about and how things are ever unveiled and revealed, is only by that dam bursting, if you like. And so I just assumed that it was probably fairly healthy in the round. But we deal with Women's World Tour teams mostly, and that's not to say in any way that any part of the sport is immune. But I agreed to do it, even though I thought, you know what, there's probably not much to it. But I did still think whatever I find will be interesting to me, and maybe I can make a story out of it. And so my first port of call was Iris Slappendale of the Cyclists Alliance, because I mean I'm such a huge fan of what they do, and I know from riders and I know from her just how much they get under the skin and are within the sport, and that they get a lot of information confidentially. And I thought, well, she'll be able to point me in the direction and advise as to whether there's a story to be told or not. And again, when I spoke to her, it was fairly similar in that she didn't really think that there was a much of a story to be told, but that nonetheless, in my first conversation with her, she was telling me things that I found really surprising. And it was an off-the-record chat. I just called her from home. She was driving at the time, and we chatted on the phone for about an hour. And she was telling me stories anecdotally, but the things that and nothing that I could have printed, because it was off the record and it was an exploratory conversation. But the things that she was saying, I thought, oh, hang on a minute, there's definitely more to this than I realised. You know, she was talking about different team managers who had various relationships, or it was understood within the peloton that they'd had various relationships with different riders. And even that just rings alarm bells, you know, because it's not necessarily a healthy way for a team to operate. If a manager is dating multiple riders, if a relationship happens, then fine, but... and there were a few other things that she said, and I thought, okay, well, maybe there's something more to this than I thought. And essentially, I asked her if she could reach out for me and speak to people, let them know I was trying to do this article, let them know what the premise was, but also let them know that I wasn't trying to sensationalise anything. I genuinely just wanted to find out if there was a story to be told. And she agreed to and came back a few weeks later with one or two names, and then it kind of went from there. I made phone calls that led to phone calls that led to phone calls, really.
And how did you find when, I mean, obviously Iris was a great help in providing introductions and vouching for you, I guess, with people that you were somebody that could be trusted, but presumably you had conversations with riders you didn't know, they didn't know you. How did you broach it with them, and what sort of approach did you take with them?
I think pretty much every conversation I had was with a rider that I'd never interviewed before. And so it's funny because I listen back to the audio of our conversations, and it takes me maybe a good 10-15 minutes at the start of the conversation to explain what I'm trying to do, because that was really important to me, that I didn't want them to think, I never want to be the kind of journalist that swoops into somebody's life and takes their story like a magpie and runs off with it and then doesn't care what happens, you know, and it's all about the story that I get. I wanted them to understand that I was trying to understand them, and that it was their story to tell, and if there wasn't a story to tell, I wasn't going to create one. And that was important for me to establish that trust, I think, from the very off. And so there was a lot of me talking for the first 10-15 minutes of the conversation, and then slowly they opened up, and I found what was really interesting was that sometimes it wasn't the most shocking bit that they would say first. And I think that comes from, I guess, from having lived a story anyway. You've got your own interpretation of it and your own memory of it. But the one story that appeared online and so informed the opener, I guess, of the interview, she, or the piece rather, she hadn't really spoken very much about what had happened to her. Her parents knew, a few other writers knew, but she hadn't told her story very often. And so it felt like, I'm speaking very in a journalistic sense here, she hadn't formulated and polished her story yet. So she wasn't giving you the main bits first. She was talking you through her whole experience with the team. And when she got to the bit that blew me away, I almost couldn't believe that wasn't the first thing that she said. That was indicative to me of the fact that she hadn't told very many people, even still, and it's a few years later, and that she was still uncomfortable with that story and owning that story and her place in it, because, as she said later, and for anyone who hasn't read the article, this is a writer who was physically, sexually assaulted by a soigneur who, when she was still a teenager, and she was on a team of teenagers, they were riding a race, and it was one of her first professional massages, and he would consistently run his thumb along her vagina while they were getting massaged, and these were teenage girls. When she continued the conversation, she was questioning herself. Did I do something that could have led him to believe that was okay? Did I react properly? Is that just what massages should be? And constantly questioning her own role in that scenario. And that was something that was common across all the women that I spoke to, that they're always thinking, well, what have I done? But that's quite societal, and that made me really sad. And actually, when I spoke to this one writer in particular, I remember, because she was in North America at the time, and so I had to time, I live in Amsterdam, so I had to time the interviews to when she was going to be awake. So I was sitting up past midnight to talk to her. And I only say that because I remember quite clearly, I was interviewing her in our spare bedroom so as to not waken the kids. And when she told me this, I just wanted to cry. I had my 4-year-old daughter sleeping in the next room, my 3-month-old son, and I just thought, really, 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 is this the world that we're still bringing our kids into? And it made me, like, I almost want to cry thinking about it. It made me so sad and so angry, so bloody, bloody angry, that this is still a society in which she's questioning her role in it. No, no. She was one of the first people I spoke to, and once she told me that story, and you can't help but relate it to your own life and relate it, you know, like I say, relating it to my daughter, and I thought, I want my daughter to be free to do whatever the hell she wants when she's old. I don't want to restrict her from a life in cycling if that's what she wants. She probably won't, but we can't just let that continue then. And so once I heard her story, I just thought, well, if that's the only story that I hear, that in itself is a valid story, but I'll keep going and see what else I find out. And so that, yeah, I was convinced very, very early on that bloody hell, there's something to it.
I mean, you can't really say too much about this, obviously, in terms of naming names and so on, but that soigneur is a, well, you're pretty sure he's a serial offender and that he still works in the sport.
I'm not sure what's happened in other teams since he moved on, but he is still in the sport. He eventually was sacked from that team, as I understand it. The rider in question did alert her team management to a situation with him. I'm not sure if she mentioned the physical sexual assault, but he was inappropriate with her in other ways, trying to develop a relationship with her, WhatsApping her, and just being uncomfortably familiar with her, she thought. And so she complained to management and said she wasn't comfortable with him. And again, I repeat, she was still a teenager and on a team of teenagers. It was a development squad for a World Tour team. And they said, oh, well, we'll have words with him. But later in that season, she was still expected to go back and live in a team house with him, except that a senior rider on the senior team had complained about him and he was given the sack. But the problem is that, well, from her interpretation anyway, the teams that want to admit this kind of thing was going on within their team, because they'll see it as something that can be held against them. And so she thinks that they never told people why he was sacked, and so he was allowed to give his version of why he was sacked. And so he was employed by another women's world tour team, and I understand that he's now been given another job. Since this article, he's been given another job with another women's world tour team. Now, a different rider, not the rider in question, but a different rider is aware of her story and told the team what he'd done. So the team know his history, and as far as I understand, he still has a job. And that makes me absolutely furious. Furious.
This is the problem, isn't it? It's not necessarily sort of happening systematically throughout the sport, but it's individuals like that aren't confronted or challenged properly because of the situation you've just described, where victims are made to feel, or you know, are manipulated to feel as if they're responsible. Now, there's a whole spectrum of, you know, abuse, from inappropriate behavior to actual physical abuse. And I want to tread carefully here, but you mentioned in the article that you had also experienced some inappropriate behavior from men working in cycling. And I know that was a dilemma for you about whether to include that and how to include that and how to give it the appropriate weight, I suppose. Presumably from that experience yourself, you know how difficult it is, even in that situation, to confront and challenge and name and shame.
Yeah. And it was a really, really difficult decision to make. Because we talked about this in the car, didn't we, at the women's tour? And I told you about the article that I was writing and said you knew what had happened to me anyway. And I'm not going to, like, overplay anything. It was two isolated groping incidents, basically. But that made me feel really uncomfortable at the time. And I confronted the people in question. One of them apologised, one of them didn't. But when I remember when I told you about those to begin with, you were quite shocked. And I thought, it was a few years later from it happening. And I remember thinking, oh, right, is that shocking? Because I think sometimes, you know, right-thinking and decent men don't realise the world that women live in. And that's not to say that women are confronted with these things all the time, but by the law of averages, you're going to get them. You are going to come across, and especially in a sport where you're meeting new people all the time and travelling all the time, you're going to meet men who do this kind of thing, and you're going to be the subject of it in some way or other. And so I think I sometimes forget that most men don't realise that this happens to women all the time. And we learn to rationalise it or accept it or not want to rock the boat. And so, yeah, so I thought it was important to include an allusion to what had happened to me for that reason, because it's part of the problem. That if, with the case I just spoke about, taken aside, because that was a physical sexual assault and there are no grey areas with that, but if it's something like an abuse of power, if it's an unwanted approach, I mean, I was touched and I wasn't even talking to the men at the time, so for me, you know, that is in law sexual assault. But there are so many, I guess, so many grades of, like you say, of what we're talking about here. And it was a common theme with all the women that I spoke to, that they questioned, well, is this my fault, or is this just society, or is this just what I should put up with? And so that's why I wanted to put it in, but it was really difficult to put it in, because you don't want to make the story about you ever, and you don't want to distract from anything. And the last thing I wanted was for anyone to pick up on that and make that the story, rather than what had happened to these women that I spent a long time bringing into my trust. And I had, like, lots of conversations with my husband about it as to whether it should go in, and if it should, and trying to explain to him why I thought it was important to put bits of it in, but we sort of worked on that bit together, because I wanted him to be okay with it, and I wanted him to be comfortable with me putting that in there. And I don't know if that's, if that again is a female trait, whereby you're thinking of everyone else around you before you actually say anything.
Well, I guess there are parallels with the famous omerta, aren't there? And an article like that, with that sort of subject matter, it's relevant. That experience is relevant. And so to not include it would be an omission.
That's what I felt. I felt it would have been... Often, as a journalist, you're supposed to take a lot of distance from the subject that you're writing about.
I just said to you, don't make that your intro.
Well, no, I think you were quite, to begin with, you're a bit like my husband in that saying, but it's not about you, so why would you put it in? And I completely see that. But, yeah, because usually as a journalist, you do take that journalistic distance. But I think with something like this, because it is so insidious, I mean, it's everywhere in society. And that's part of the story. Because then the fewer people that say, no, that's not okay, the more people think, oh, that must be okay then. So if I'm to write that story... And I know that I was groped and didn't put it in, when it's a piece about that, to an extent, then that's almost me saying, Yeah, but my situation is different because, well, what's different about any of it? We should all be able to say, no, that is wrong, and here's why it's wrong, and just stick together on it, I guess. And so, yeah, for me, there is that emerita to it, and there is that... If every single person is told, but you can't say that because your situation is different, and you shouldn't really do that because he might feel a bit bad, and you shouldn't speak up because such and such, then nobody ever speaks up. And then it becomes an issue that we don't talk about and is continually perpetuated. And I'm okay, and I'm making inverted commas here, because I'm generally quite a strong, confident person. But this happened when I was starting out in cycling. I had no idea what the world of cycling was like. And I've spoken to one person in the piece, in the longer form piece. And I would urge people, if they're interested in it, to read the longer form piece, because you only really get one story in the online piece. And there are so many more stories that I guess show you that it's a bigger problem. But one woman I spoke to said, you know, she's been in cycling all her adult life. And she's very strong, and I was really impressed by her and her feistiness. But when she had an incident happen to her, she was at a very vulnerable time in her life, and that can happen to all of us. And you come out of that and you think, oh, it's just because I was vulnerable. No, somebody spotted that vulnerability and decided to prey on it. And I think you do have to think of it in terms of how we make our society a better society to live in for the girls that are coming next and for the boys that don't grow up thinking that this is okay. They're taught it's okay by the men older than them doing it and getting away with it, and you think, well, that's just society then. Well, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast Feminin, brought to you by Skoda, dedicated to closing the gender gap in cycling, one race, one cyclist at a time. This is our time.
Thank you very much indeed to Skoda for their very generous support of the Cycling Podcast Femina. They backed us last year from the Women's Tour onwards, and again this year, and we're really grateful to them, not only for supporting us, but for putting so much into women's sport and women's cycling as well, especially women's cycling. And one of their initiatives is the Skoda Cycling Academy. We had a little piece about that in a previous episode of Cycling Podcast Femina. And I went and spent a day with them, or an afternoon with them, at the Telegraph offices recently. They were being put through their paces, being given media training, and I was somehow part of that order. Can you believe that?
Well, I think one of them tweeted thanking you, didn't they? They said it was a very interesting and informative afternoon. I guess they have nothing to base that on. Maybe their only benchmark.
Well, one of them tweeted saying thanks to Roger Moore from the Cycling Podcast.
Oh, maybe that's the tweet I saw. Sorry, I didn't even notice the mistake in that one.
I'm not gonna name and shame, but the girl in question is actually a listener to the podcast. I know she was embarrassed by that, so I'm not gonna name her, but thank you.
So well done in not like flagging that up on the podcast.
Don't worry about that. Really, it's gone now. It's been corrected. But no, it was really interesting to meet them, and they've all got very different backgrounds and experiences, and it was great to see the sort of journey that they're on, helped by Skoda. So here's a little flavour of that day and of who they are.
I'm Megan Dickerson, I'm 22 and I'm from Bristol. At college, I used to ride my bike to college and from college and to work and things. And when I went to university, I took my bike with me and I thought it would be a really great way to meet kind of different people outside of my course. So I joined the cycling club there and yeah, just kind of went from there. When I initially applied, it was just kind of like, do you want to further your kind of cycling career? So I think it was kind of, I wasn't really sure, and then we went to the testing day, found out a bit more information about what was involved. I think basically it's just really great experience and being able to be an advocate for women's cycling. I think it's really important to me that a lot of the races I go to and a lot of the events I'm at, like, there's not that strength and depth of the field. And I think to be able to get more women into cycling and show that it's a really great sport to be involved in and it's a really great community as well is really important to me. Yeah, so the testing day at Lee Valley Velo Park was really intense. You sort of turned up and there was like 40 other women and everyone looked really strong and amazing, and there were some girls who were kind of, I don't know, just seemed like they all knew each other from racing in London and different places, and it was all a bit intense. And then we did a 12-minute test, a 3-minute test and a 6-second test, and then an outdoor lap. The testing indoors was just really hard. Like, I didn't really do much indoor riding or kind of like watt bike stuff, so just doing that and just the pain and having everyone surrounding you and just being sweating, and it was really, really intense, but really good fun. And I think really good opportunity to be able to like push ourselves and try and prove kind of what we had. And then we did a lap outdoors in the pouring rain and freezing cold. It was really hard and really windy. There was like a massive headwind, but that was really good fun. The friendship of the girls that we've been riding with, like we've actually had just such a great summer, and the events we've attended together have been really great fun. And then also like the coaching and advice from Sarah, and just kind of different kind of insight that she's given us into the world of cycling and the world of cycling in the UK and women's cycling has been really good.
My name is Meredith, I'm 21 and I'm from down in Brighton. I started commuting to work, so I sort of had a desk job and it was nice to get outside. And that commute sort of grew. I took the 10-mile route at first, and then I decided to take the 12-mile route with the big hill, and then I decided to take the 15 route with the even bigger hill, and then recently I've started taking the 18-mile route. There was sort of a cycle scheme going on when I started commuting called Cycle September, and they have a little leaderboard of people that are doing the most miles. It was just in Brighton, and I just took it on myself that I was going to do 500 miles that month. And I'd only been cycling a couple of months, but I was like very determined to get that number. So I was doing it every day and sort of adding extra miles and stuff. And I did that, I reached my 500 miles. And I kind of said, oh, if I carry on cycling through winter, sort of every day, much to my mum's disappointment, through snow and like the dark evenings, I could get a road bike in the spring. And yeah, so I did that, and I got my road bike around May of this year. I mean, when I got my road bike this year, I was sort of looking at entering a few sportives and things, and I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll do the 46-mile ones. 100 miles is way too much. You'll never do that. So yeah, it's sort of escalated a lot faster than I ever planned.
My name's Jasmine, Jazz Jones. I'm from Cardiff and I'm 23. I got into cycling at uni, the classic, where I was at Freshers' Fair and I had a bike, and one of the cycling guys asked if I wanted to join. So I joined and literally haven't looked back since. It's been my uni journey with cycling, it was amazing. I met so many good people. So we got a phone call actually to tell us initially that we got through, which was super exciting. So obviously I just went for a bike ride because I was too excited, and then got home and social media had just blown up. So Sarah had done us a little video, or done me a little video telling me I'd got through, and I just, it all then kind of escalated very quickly, and suddenly we were being whisked off to here, there and everywhere for cycling. So it was all a bit of a blur really, which was really cool. But we've had lots of good opportunity to talk to Sarah, get a lot of information off her, which has been really cool. So I think with women in cycling, it's quite difficult because there isn't a clear path. There isn't a, okay, next step I'll get onto a domestic team, then after that I'll apply for this, that and the other, because there aren't the teams to apply for. So I'm racing National Series as an independent rider. I ride for my local club, which is full of mammals, and they're great, but I don't get the support I need or I would get if I was at their next level. And the training I'm doing is equivalent to my boyfriend, who's on like a semi-pro contract, and yet I'm not. I'm just riding at a club level, and I pay for my own entries and I pay for all my coaching and everything. So the next step would be to get on to a good team for the next season. So at least if I'm in a race and I'm at a National Series race and it's hot, someone can give me a bottle. It's just small things like that which can actually make such a big difference to your performance on the day.
I'm Rebecca Richards. I am 21 and I am from Newark, Nottinghamshire. I started out at school with British Cycling. They came along and did some what they called go ride sessions specifically for the ladies in my year. Yeah, that's basically how I got going with it all. I started winning quite a few of those races, and yeah, just the competitive side came out of me. Yeah, it was super exciting when they said that I'd been accepted. It does give you a good idea of what the professionals get to live like. Yeah, I just wanted to try and get my name out there, really. I think it's super hard as a lady from somewhere that doesn't have many local races to really shout about your name and try and promote yourself. So, yeah, that's mainly what I wanted out of it.
Morgan Newberry, 20, Leicester.
I've probably been properly cycling, getting into it with regular rides for like the last 5 years. I'd have to give a lot of credit to my old man. He's always ridden his bike, but I use it a lot for commuting. But then over the last 5 years, kind of got inspired by a few bits at school. But actually, I think the tip of it to get me going was the London 2012 Olympics and Paralympics, with Sarah Story doing amazingly well and all of the GB team. And from there I was kind of like, oh, I want to move this on, I want to get going with this too. I've done a para national, the national championships road race, and then I've just done a few crit races and a few time trials, which I've really been enjoying, but nothing major yet. I've got a really exciting opportunity in September to race the UCI Para International, so that's going to be my biggest event so far, and it's really exciting. So the ETAP was mega. It was the hardest ride, and not just physically, but it was mental challenge. It's more than just a standard ride out in the UK. You know, I ride the Peak District quite a lot, but riding the ETAP was the first 10 kilometres had me. I've never rode so many lengthy climbs, and the finish on Val Thorens just was incredible. We had big heat. We had 35 degrees going on, and obviously. Just going up forever, and people, it was a really great day to see a lot of people out there. Obviously there was thousands of us, and not many females were there, and because of how hard it really was, people were just going back down the mountain, and it was like, no, we're going to finish this, and all five of the Skoda riders all finished it, so it was really great to finish that.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast, and you can get 25% off your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. scienceandsport.com, SISCP25. Orla, what were you telling me about bananas?
Well, just when you said flavour.
It's fit for broadcast.
It is fit for broadcast, thank you very much. Just when you said flavour, I just was telling you a little anecdote. A fact, that I think it's a fact, it has to be stood up yet. I learned last night that apparently, you know how banana-flavoured things don't taste of bananas? And that's always bothered me. Like little banana chews look like a banana in shape and colour, but they don't taste anything like it. Well, apparently, banana flavour is based on a banana that went out of cultivation in about 1952. So they taste of an old breed of banana that was in the 50s. And so that's reassured me somewhat, because now I think, well, if I can eat banana flavoured things and sort of imagine myself smoking a cigar and fretting over the Cuban Missile Crisis, that maybe it'll be a little bit more romantic now. So I quite like that. I haven't stood that up, but Matt Stevens, his wife Holly, told me that, and she's intelligent, so I'm going to go with that.
Wow, every day is a school day, isn't it? You learn something new every day. Orla, before we go today, some good news. We've got extra episodes of the Cycling Podcast Femina coming out over the World Championships. One next week, during World Championship week, and then one the week after following the World Championship. So that's additional content coming your way. They'll be a bit different, these episodes, I think. One thing I'm going to do is catch up with William Fotheringham, who's just written a book about Beryl Burton. I'm going to have a chat about that. And, you know, give you a flavour of the World Championships as well. But you're not going to be there, unfortunately, Orla. And I'm not sure if Rose is going to be there either at this stage. So they could be a little bit different. I'll get one of you on the phone at some point.
Yeah, I'm absolutely gutted to be missing out. It's a prior work commitment. It's going to be an amazing event. If you've got any chance to go to the World Road Race Championships, please, please do it. It's just going to be... I mean, we loved Innsbruck last year, and I think even the Yorkshire presentation at Innsbruck blew everybody away. They swore, as they always do, it's going to be the biggest, the best, the loudest World Championships ever. So, yeah, I do want to catch up on the phone and maybe quiz you about what it's been like. I want you to give me a flavour of the atmosphere, banana, please, and just let me know what it's all going to be like. I think it's going to be awesome.
It was a really nice holiday, wasn't it, in Innsbruck last year?
It was. Yeah, enjoy your holly bobs.
Well, if you are going to be in Harrogate, Cycling Podcast are doing a live show on the Friday evening at the Royal Hall. Team of us will be there, and a special guest, Matt White from Mitchelton Scott. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com. If you click on live events, you'll see our various events there, including our November tour, where you, Orla, will be joining us for some of those events. Still to be confirmed.
To be confirmed, but I better go because my mum's already bought tickets for the one in Belfast, so I think I better be there.
You better. That's all for now, though. Thank you very much, Orla.
Muchas gracias.
You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina, in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.